Our first case this morning is Godovac versus Trejo. Case number is 20-2143. Will counsel for appellant enter his appearance and proceed?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Blair Dunn, and I'm here on behalf of the appellants this morning. So I would like to first acknowledge to the court a couple things. First, I would like to thank the court for the opportunity to argue what may be one of the last few cases that I get to argue regarding qualified immunity in front of this court because of a change in the law that we had in New Mexico this last year. So I do take this opportunity. I do take this opportunity to thank the court for that. I also would like to acknowledge right up front that I understand a little bit of the uphill climb that we do have with this case, given the state of the law regarding qualified immunity, both from the Supreme Court and from this circuit. But I do think that I'd like to focus the court initially on our reply brief. And I know the danger that's associated to having a football analogy. Your Honor, if I might pause for a moment, I feel like my opposing counsel is having some issues. She's raised her hand. Can we stop for just a moment to make sure there's not something wrong?
All right. So can you hear us now, Ms. Andrew?
I can. Thank you so much, Your Honor.
All right. I think we're ready to resume. Mr. Dunn, you may proceed. We may have to give you a little bit of time because of the interruption, but why don't we go ahead and see where we are at the end of the time?
Thank you, Your Honor. And I appreciate the court's letting us slow down and figuring out for opposing counsel's sake what was going on with that. But as I was beginning to elaborate, I really do think that this is, while this is a, as Judge Browning clearly noted, a unique take on how we could get to clearly established that didn't satisfy his judgment. I do believe that when you look at the whole of what we have in the racing industry and the whole of the body of law surrounding the racing industry and the statute itself that says that racing is supposed to be conducted in a fair manner. And when you combine that with the idea that a person engaged in the racing industry has a due process right to engage in their chosen profession that entitles them to that due process of law, I do think that when you look at the body as a whole, this was established. I don't think that it is accurate for the appellees in this instance to say that they weren't on notice, that if they broke their own rules, which is an arbitrary and capricious thing to do, and they engaged in tinkering ultimately with the outcome of the biggest race in quarter horse racing, that they weren't on notice that what they were doing was affecting the due process rights of the people that were affected by their failure to follow their rules. And that's really what this case boils down to. We did boil it down to a sports analogy, and I acknowledge that when it comes to sports analogies, you run a risk of potentially alienating, especially when you're using pro football teams, the very people that you want to be making a decision in your favor. I hope that my use of the Buccaneers and the Chiefs in this instance didn't cause any consternation with the court. It was purely a hypothetical.
Just so I'm clear, which regulation are you relying on? That would bar transfer of horses trained by a disqualified trainer to other non-disqualified trainers? I've read the regulations and that doesn't pop right out to me.
There's a regulation regarding suspension of horses I'm sorry, Your Honor, my memory is just not quite there this morning to pull the exact regulation number, but we do cite to it in the complaint in this matter, this part of the appendix, and I don't have the cite readily offhand, but it is cited in the complaint. It's cited in the briefing in front of the district court, and I believe we make mention of it in our opening brief.
Are you extrapolating, or do you think the regulation says it that plainly?
No, the regulation really does say it that plainly, that a horse that is found to have violated the Substances Act, the other regulations, that the horse is supposed to be suspended with the trainer, and it clearly prohibits allowing those horses to be transferred to another trainer and then continue on. That circumvents the whole purpose of the rules themselves, not just the plain language of it, but the whole purpose of the rules is so that horses and owners and their trainers don't benefit from using substances. And this would enable essentially the horse and the owners of the horse to escape their liability for using a prohibited substance. And that's exactly what happened here. These horses were under one trainer, supposed to be suspended. They tested positive. That those trainers' horses were not supposed to be able to transfer. And yet the Racing Commission ignored that regulation. They ignored the statutes, and they went ahead and transferred these horses to another trainer and allowed them to run. Now, if they had followed the rules, the natural outcrop of that would have been that my client's horse pulled into the end of the race and would have had the opportunity to play in the Super Bowl of horse racing.
Well, counsel, could I just ask you to place this argument within the due process analytical framework? That is, first of all, how were your clients deprived of a liberty or property interest in practicing their profession?
Yes, Your Honor. Using the Berry versus Barchi case, there is a fundamental interest in engaging in your chosen profession that you're supposed to be entitled to due process of law. That's the liberty interest that we are saying that they were deprived of.
All right, now, but there was no their license wasn't revoked, right? They weren't prevented from participating at all, correct?
That's correct.
And they were able to enter in the qualifying races. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So my question is, just to make sure I understand what you're arguing, are you arguing that the plaintiffs were entitled to have their horse entered in qualifying races without any of Mr. Woods's horses? Is that the interest alleged here?
That, Your Honor, that's a great question, and you have a fair point on the interest that's alleged. What's alleged here, and this is the discussion we had with the district court, what is alleged here is not the specific race or that these horses had a property interest in that race. What they had a property interest in, based upon what the statute says and what the case law says, is they had a property interest to be able to compete fairly. And that's the interest that we've argued. And I understand a just outside the circle type of analysis.
Well, I come back to where Judge Phillips started. Does state law actually support what you just said? That is, the ability that the state law protect or require that your clients have the ability to have a horse entered in a race that doesn't have any of Mr. Woods's horses. I mean, did the state law actually require that?
Our argument is, Your Honor, that it does, because it says in the Horse Racing Act statute itself that the Racing Commission is supposed to allow for the fair, and they use the term in the statute, fair administration of horse racing. That's what the statute says. That means that you have a right to compete fairly. Maybe you don't have and this is the distinction the district court didn't agree with us on. You may not have a right to engage in just that race. And that's the distinction we're arguing, is that that race is a consequence. That's the damage, is that particular race. What they were deprived of is the right to compete fairly. And that was done without due process. And so we're drawing the line as to when they were deprived of the right before the particular race. And that's the novel argument that I acknowledge. It isn't that all that clear in the law, other than we have these cases from the New Mexico Courts of Appeals, and we have the statute itself saying that you have this right to engage in this profession. So if you have the right to engage in this particular profession, even a decision in front of the United States Supreme Court, and you have a statute that says you have a right to engage in it, that it's supposed to be conducted fairly, we think that when you take the part of that fairness away, that's where you lost part of the right.
And are you arguing that these horses would have qualified, or are you arguing that it doesn't matter whether it would qualify?
We're arguing that it doesn't matter. We're arguing that the deprivation of the right was the right to engage in the profession. The consequence, the damage that results from that denial was that they didn't get it's for instance, I think the closest analogy would be some sort of a medical malpractice, wrongful death type of case where a person is denied the opportunity for something. That denial of the opportunity is what is the damages. The act is, of course, the whatever caused the wrongful death. Here, it's the shutting off of the license for the biggest game, but it was the shutting off the license or not allowing the license to compete fairly, the licensee to compete fairly. That's what we argue is the difference.
So, counsel, where did your client's horse finish?
They had a couple, but the one that at issue, I believe, finished fifth and would have pulled into the race, but for the horses that were in front of them being allowed to continue on.
Okay, so it would without the Woods horse, because I don't think it was entirely clear in the complaint, but without the Woods horses, your client's horse would have qualified for the All-American.
Yes, Your Honor, they would have pulled in essentially.
All right.
Well, wouldn't other horses have run in their place? Or those are your horses.
No, so if it's win, place, show, or 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and my client's horses are down the line, a certain number of them qualify. And if those times from those two horses in front of them go away, then they bump up and they make a qualifier into the race.
Right. I guess that sort of begs another question, and that is, if the Woods horses were scratched and couldn't run, would two other horses have been put in the qualifiers?
No, that's our argument, is that the Woods horses ran in the qualifier with my client's horses.
No, I understand that. But if they had not, would two other horses have been allowed to run in their place, or would the field have been smaller?
No, it would have pulled everybody up. So it's a certain number of horses that run in the race based upon a series of qualifiers. So when those horses of the Woods horses are allowed to remain, those spots don't open up for other people to pull up and in. But it wasn't just my client's horses that were affected by this. It actually was. There were other similarly situated trainers because of the number of horses that were allowed to continue to race and to transfer that potentially could have made it into the race. So it wasn't just my clients that were harmed by this arbitrary action by the racing commission director and the stewards to do what they did.
Okay. And I guess that sort of brings me back. If the Woods, is it a certainty that after all the times were in, if the Woods horses had not run, would your client's horse have run in the All-American? Because what it sounds like is maybe there were some other horses at play too, and that it wasn't a certainty that these horses kept your horse from running.
Your Honor, that's a very good question. And I think that gets in line with the idea of, are we asking that we had a right to this particular race, or are we asking that we were denied the right to compete fairly? The answer to your question is that it's not certain, but it doesn't matter in this instance because they were in an opportunity to have run in that race. So there's a series of qualifiers here. They never got the chance to advance to getting to the All-American. And that's what we're arguing, is that they were denied the right, and so therefore they weren't able to compete fairly. And maybe their horses win and maybe they don't. But the point is that they've lost the opportunity and they were not allowed. And that's because of an arbitrary action by the government to break their own rules, essentially.
Let's come back to where you started about the steep hill to climb. Where's the clearly established law here?
Your Honor, the closest thing we've pointed to is, in a general sense, Berry. And then we have cases from the New Mexico Courts of Appeals that we cited to, and the statute itself. So we think that body of law in toto, applying the law, substantive law from New Mexico, is clearly established, sufficient to give notice to the appellees in this instance. And if the court has other questions, I'm happy to answer those, or if I could, I'd reserve the last minute of my time.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Anderman?
Yes, thank you, Your Honors. You can hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, good. Your Honor, there's nothing, Your Honors, there's nothing sure in a horse race. That's just the way the sport goes. And the problem that plaintiffs have here is that they overgeneralize. They try to say that the property right is just the right to run in a single race when it clearly is not. This is a 1983 case, and the plaintiffs have to show the existence of a constitutionally protected right and actual deprivation of an identifiable government benefit. So in this case, we have neither a constitutionally protected right, nor do we have deprivation of a benefit. How can the unknown outcome of a horse race be a property interest? I think Your Honors have the same problem that Mr. Trejo has. And for whatever reason, the cases that Mr. Dunn cites do not include the 10th Circuit cases that we cited that make it absolutely clear that there is no property interest in a single race, and there's no liberty interest that exists from being prohibited from running from a single race. It did not affect the licensure of this individual horse or the owners, so it did not in any way affect the outcome. So, Your Honor, I want to make sure that you are clear, and actually, I really think the plaintiff's own exhibits crystallize defendant's position in this case. Attached to their complaint, since this was on a motion to dismiss, is Exhibit 1. And Exhibit 1 is the Notice of Summary Suspension for Mr. Wood. On that notice itself, it clearly states all transfers and sale of horses trained, owned, or in the care and custody of Mr. Wood must be done in accordance with regulations. So by virtue of that language, they are acknowledging that there are going to be transfers. It is not correct that you can't transfer a horse just because a trainer is disqualified. Clearly, that trainer cannot continue in that capacity, but there is no limitation on the ability to transfer. The only limitation, which is one of the regulations that Mr. Dunn cites, is that you can't transfer to the assistant trainer. In other words, the barred trainer cannot then transfer to the assistant trainer, nor can they transfer to a spouse or to a close relative. So those are the limitations.
Yes. Ms. Fetterman, on these points that you're making, what is your position on whether Mr. Trejo violated any commission rules or regulations in this matter?
He absolutely did not, Your Honor, because transfers are allowed. And we cited to the New Mexico Administrative Code, section 15.2.5.8b2. Now, as I pointed out, the notice of from the Racing Commission about the suspension acknowledges the transfer. But with regard to this particular race, it says that race entry is in the name of an owner and a trainer. Normally, once there is an entry, transfer is not allowed except with permission of the stewards. So this does give discretion to Mr. Trejo. And Mr. Trejo, I want to point out in Exhibit 2 to plaintiff's complaint, which is page 019 of the Record on Appeal, where he issued his memorandum explaining what happened. Basically, it says, when rendering the decision, the New Mexico Racing Commission and its legal counsel took a hard look at the facts surrounding the timing. And so, in other words, he did not do this just capriciously. He went to legal counsel. And what in fact happened, and I don't know if it's 100% clear, so I'm going to make sure that the timeline is clear. What happened was the notice of a positive drug test came into the office on August 7th, which was a Wednesday. And all that comes in is just there's been a positive test and it corresponds to number blah, 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 because they don't list the name of the horse. Well, the office manager was not there. So as it turned out, because it came in late in the day, then the next day she was not there. On August 9th, that was the day for all the entries for the qualifiers to be in. And that was the first time that anybody in the office manager's office actually saw the notice of the positive drug test. So they reviewed it, identified that it was Mr. Wood, and he was put into a temporary suspension. on that very day. Well, that was the day for the entries for these qualifiers. Now, Mr. Wood clearly was not eligible to be the trainer once he's on suspension. And normally that would result in the owners who wish to do so to transfer to another trainer. And that is consistent with the notice of suspension. And it is consistent with every regulation that we've cited. I mean, it is absolutely clear that if an individual trainer or owner is disqualified, there's no bar to the transfer. The only thing that was unusual here was that this race was coming up. And what gives Mr. Trejo the discretion then is that rule that I cited, which says once there is an entry, and that's what happened, everybody put their entries in on the 9th, but then the suspension notice came out on the 9th. So what Mr. Trejo did in consultation with legal counsel was to decide, what do we do with this situation? We were out of the office yesterday and there was nobody to process this. And now this deadline is here on the 9th. So after discussion with counsel, he issued the memo, but there's nothing whatsoever that prohibits him from doing what he did. So we would not even concede there's a violation. And then beyond that, even if there were a violation, there's no due process right. Does that answer your question, Your Honor? So as we pointed out, all the regulations are basically concede that there is a right to transfer a horse. The only limitation then with that they're talking about when they say a transfer of a horse to avoid application of a rule is that they can't transfer to an assistant trainer, their spouse, or a relative. So those are the prohibitions. And all that Mr. Trejo did then was to allow the transfer, a discretionary transfer under the rules, so that the individuals who had already entered their horse, paid their fees, were allowed to run. Although Mr. Wood was not allowed to participate, and the horse that was involved in the tainting the illegal drug was not allowed to participate. They didn't even try.
So what if the person had been in the office on Wednesday? Then what would have happened?
What would have happened, Your Honor, is that they would have issued the suspension that day. And then the individual owners who were implicated because they had Mr. Wood as their trainer would have had the opportunity to fill out the to get a different trainer, fill out the paperwork with that trainer's name. So there's nothing wrong with the transfer process itself. That's done all the time. And like I say, all the rules clearly anticipated. They talk about transfers. So it was just this weird timing thing. And that's why Mr. Trejo felt, you know, he had to consider what to do with this. You know, people were upset. And he basically said, you know, it was our fault. We didn't have somebody in the office. Nobody should be penalized as a result of that. Now, going back to constitutional rights, are we talking about a clearly established constitutional right? Clearly not. I appreciate your questions because they're pertinent, but they don't get plaintiffs to where they need to be with regard to a government benefit that was wrongfully deprived. So purely consistent with the regulations and with the spirit of fairness that Mr. Trejo exercised his statutory right to decide to allow these transfers under the situation. Now, plaintiff seems to not want to discuss the key cases out of this 10th Circuit that clearly show that the right to engage in a particular race is not a protected right under 1983 due process. There are actually three cases that we cited, and I really like the town of Castle Rock case that we cited from the Supreme Court as well, because what's interesting about that case is that they really talk in detail about what speculative rights anyone has for due process in that situation, if it's truly speculative and very tentative. So what that case law establishes is that you cannot have a right that is so speculative be the foundation of a due process claim. It establishes that loss of eligibility, or as plaintiff wants to say, loss of a chance, is not the same as the loss of the benefit itself. And yes, sir. Oh, and what state law provides cannot be a discretionary benefit if one is arguing that it's the foundation of a due process claim. The other thing that the Castle Rock case really stresses is the traditional conception of property. And what property interest are we talking about here? And in fact, if one carries this through, if one were to suggest that Mr. Dunn is correct, what are his damages? Is he saying he would have won the race? You know, I mean, it's just so speculative. We're far beyond what due process would protect.
Now that you bring that up, I'm still not clear that his client's horse would have run in the All-American had these other two horses not been allowed to race.
You're exactly right, Your Honor. The problem is it is a horse race. And how this is done is there each horse is paired with another horse during the trials. And so it would have been a totally different mix of horses. And it's not to say that Mr. Dunn's client's horse would have indeed succeeded in making the cutoff on that day. I mean, he can argue that, but there's no certainty. And like I say, a horse race is a horse race, and there are so many variables, which again goes to the whole problem of trying to establish a property interest on this basis. Clearly, we cannot tell in advance what would have happened. Now, the other thing I want to point out, and this kind of dovetails with what you're saying, if the plaintiffs had seriously thought that there was an infraction by Mr. Trejo, they could have done things before the race. Going back to the football analogy, if you have a problem in the first half and you don't like the referee's call, you don't wait till you've lost the game to challenge that call, right? So there were procedures that the plaintiffs could have used if they truly thought that this was a violation of a regulation. They could have filed a complaint and gotten a review by the commission itself. There's a procedure for that. They could have sought a TRO saying this was clearly established and that Mr. Woods, formerly Mr. Woods' horses, shouldn't have been allowed to run. Or they could have sought mandamus or prohibition. I mean, there were lots of things they could have done before the fact. There's speaking of fairness, there's not a lot of fairness when after you've run the race and haven't succeeded. And then here we have the plaintiffs coming and saying, oh, well, we would have won, but for this. So it sounds like sour grapes, and that's kind of what it is. I mean, Mr. Trejo had to make a discretionary call, which is inconsistent. The fact that he gets to use his discretion is inconsistent with the notion of a property interest. So basically, the Castanon case supports us, and that, of course, is the 10th Circuit case, saying exactly that there is no property interest in a single race. We have the Simon versus Taylor case. Again, nothing in the rules is so mandatory that it creates a right to rely on that language. So even if we had a violation, which we do not agree, that in and of itself, again, would not give rise to the property interest. And particularly where the plaintiff had other avenues that he could have pursued if he truly believed that it was non-discretionary on the part of Mr. Trejo. So we basically have no clearly established law that was violated. Sure, we all agree that there's a property interest under the Constitution and there's a liberty interest in your profession, but you've got to identify that deprivation of a clearly legitimate entitlement to a government benefit. And that is just wholly missing from this case. Do your honors have any other questions for me? Okay, I waive the rest of my time then. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Dunn, you have some rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I want to get immediately to the heart of the matter. We are not arguing that there's a property interest in a particular race. We are arguing that there is a property interest in competing fairly and this was not fair. It was the opposite of fair. Specifically, in the district courts, and I'm looking at the appendix at page 85, to answer a little bit more thoroughly Judge Phillips' question, the ruling, which that ruling is supposed to stand and go through due process hearings, says that effective upon the date of the suspension dates, all horses trained and under Woods' care are ineligible to race or to transfer, or that any transfer sales must be done in accordance. That's what you heard from counsel read. But the point of it is those horses had all been ruled ineligible. And without going through any due process, Mr. Trejo just waves his magic director's wand and it goes away. That is exactly the point that we're driving at. And I've used my time, so I appreciate the court's indulgence this morning.
Thank you, counsel. Case will be submitted and counsel are excused.